Today's Teisho will be on case 75 in the Book of Serenity. 75 is entitled Rion's Constant Principle. Introduction. Even as you call it thusness, it's already changed. Where knowledge doesn't reach, avoid speaking of it. Here, is there any investigation or not? Ryuan asked Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? Yanto said, moving. Ryuan said, when moving, what then? Yanto said, you don't see the fundamental constant principle. Ryuan stood there thinking. Yanto said, if you agree, you are not free of sense and matter. If you don't agree, you'll be sunk forever in birth and death. Verse. The round pearl has no hollows. The great raw gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges. Removing the road of agreement, senses and matter are empty. The free body resting on nothing stands out unique and alive. So I want to thank everybody for coming here to practice Zazen this morning on this beautiful spring day. Thank you so much for coming. This is a wonderful koan, Ryuan's Constant Principle. Last night there is a person who has been sitting with our group for a long time. He was practicing quite regularly for a while, for I would say like 8 years actually. And then he probably began to feel frustrated with his practice. And he, I think it's fair to say he was wondering what he was doing with his life, sitting on a cushion so often. And he began to step away from his practice and would come here to sit once in a while, and then not at all. He got married to a wonderful person, and he has a little daughter, and he is very good at his job. He's a really wonderful person. And I always wondered what happened to him, and then about maybe like a year ago, or a little bit more than a year ago, he came back to sit a little tentatively at first, and then he's been coming a little bit more regularly. So I've been so happy to see that. And so last night, we didn't have a dokusan. We just had a conversation here in the Zendo. So I don't think I'm revealing anybody's secrets, since he talked about it to me very openly with lots of people in the room. But he said, my thoughts, sometimes my thoughts really bother me. He said, my thoughts, and I think that's how he put it. He said, my thoughts, sometimes they really bother me. And he said, sometimes when I've been sitting on the cushion, trying to get back to the cushion, I'll sit down on the cushion and I'm frustrated by what I'm thinking. And then he said, today I was sitting on the cushion, or lately I've been sitting on the cushion, and my thoughts don't bother me so much. And I said, I think that's because you are getting back into blank mind. I think that you are not so trapped by your thoughts, because sometimes spaces are opening up between one thought and another, empty spaces or blank spaces. And I waited to see his response, and he said, yes, I think that's true. I think that's what's happening. you know, it takes a lot of sitting to find that blankness. You know, when we sit down on the cushion at first, you know, it seems as though thoughts are all there is to our consciousness when we stop focusing on events around us. You know, so when you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, if you close your eyes or you open your eyes, you'll notice that your mind is full of thoughts, right? And there's different levels of thought or different kinds of thinking. You know, if you've just come from work, you know, when you sit down on the cushion, you may find that you're thinking about something at work. Like, it does happen to me sometime when I meditate, I'll suddenly realize, especially at the beginning of a sit, I'll realize that I have to write this letter to somebody. And I've been putting it off, and suddenly I realize I haven't written that letter yet. And there's like a little charge of like emotion, like, oh no, you know. So, you know, when you sit down on the cushion, there might be these rather complete conscious thoughts, you know, like, I have to get that letter done, or I've forgotten that letter. And then, you know, if you keep watching the breath, you keep sitting, those kinds of conscious, complete thoughts begin to recede. And under that level of thought, there's like this other level of thought, which is like these fragments of thoughts. And if you've been sitting for a little while, some of your sits are like that, right? It's like if you're tuning a radio and the tuner doesn't work, and it's just going back and forth up and down the bandwidth of the radio. You know, you're getting this and this and this and this and this and this little pieces of you know, classical music, and then jazz, and then news show, and then top 40, and then you're back to jazz, or you're back, you know. Your mind is a little bit like that. Under the level of your conscious, complete thoughts, there's like this level of fragments of thoughts. And there's pieces of things floating in there, and it flows by like a stream of consciousness. You know, and some of it is almost a complete sentence, and some of it's just little pieces. You know, and people who are beginners actually have to watch the breath a lot just to get to that place. And it's possible, if you don't do much meditation, to think that's all there is. But if you keep practicing, you know, under that level of pieces of thought, there are there's like memory storehouse, right? So memories come up, and they can be very, especially if you've been meditating for a few hours, you can have memories that you might have forgotten for years, and they can be very emotionally resonant. You know, it's like something just drifts up out of your memory, and there it is, and it's very moving, perhaps, you know, or not, you know. Lots of emotion under there, and there's also like visualization, a dimension to consciousness. So, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you begin to watch your breath, you go from those complete sentences, those full ideas, down to fragments. You hit a level of the mind, if you think of the mind as sort of like having these levels or layers. There's a layer that's like memory. And there's also like a layer that's actually like sort of imagination, right? And so when you sit, you go up and down and up and down through these layers, but every once in a while, you stumble into a layer of the mind that's actually quite blank. And one way to think about it is under all these other layers, there's like this core of the mind. If you think of the, you know, mind as like a sphere, and there are these layers, and you go down through the layers, the core of the mind, there's like this blank blankness. And when people sit a fair amount, they begin to experience that blankness. And it may just be at first just like a split second. You know, you're in the fragments of thoughts. You have a memory of going down the shore when you were five. Then you think of your sister and you realize, I have to call my sister. Then you start watching the breath again, and all of a sudden there's like a space between your thoughts. And then the thoughts pick up again, and then there's a space. And we experience it as a space or a moment of blankness. But actually, it's that blankness is always there. It's always there under the surface of these other things going on. So it's like, the top of a body of water can be blown by the wind, and storms can whip up heavy waves. But maybe at the bottom there's just this motionless, the water is motion, a very deep water is motionless. As you go up, there are currents and there's waves and so on and so on. So the mind is very much like that. We don't necessarily experience it as going down through the layers of the mind, but the core of the mind is this blankness. And when you begin to do zazen, at first it's very difficult just to focus on the breath. Because your thoughts, that stream of consciousness sweeps you away with it. So if you're not careful, especially if you meditate at home, you can sit down on the cushion and that stream of thought can just catch you and carry you for 20 minutes. And you'll look at your watch and you'll think, where was I? You were just drifting along. This is actually not good. You should not allow yourself to do that too much. When you sit in a more formal setting like this, I think it's a little easier not to let that happen. You sort of realize you remind yourself that you have to pull yourself back. But it's definitely a struggle at first, right? Your mind is buzzing with thoughts. That stream of consciousness is just rolling along. As soon as you sit down on the cushion and begin to quiet the mind, it feels quiet at first, and then you go down into that level of bubbling fragments, memories, and so on. And you're dragging yourself back to the breath. But little by little, you begin to have this encounter with these spaces between your thoughts. It's like you follow the breath and then you think about dinner. And then you follow the breath and you can see your thought coming and going. But when it comes and goes, there's a little empty space between each of your thoughts. Or you'll just be watching the breath and suddenly you'll realize your mind is just blank. Just blank. And then it's back to thinking. As soon as you realize, oh, it's blank, that's a strange thing. You start carrying on a mental dialogue, and then the blankness disappears. But if you keep practicing, you get back to that blankness more and more. And in our culture, we are not well prepared for that experience. So in the West, we have a saying, something is better than nothing. Right? Something's better. Something is always better than nothing. I was just listening to a song I like by the Doobie Brothers. This is dating me, but the Doobie Brothers were a great band back in the 70s, and they have a wonderful song called "What a Fool Believes," and. That one of the lines is that something's always better than nothing. And that is such a Western way of thinking. We have this idea that nothingness is threatening or menacing, or emptiness. So when we talk about emptiness in the West, we usually mean a state that's very unfortunate, right? Empty. He's an empty person. But actually, that empty state is highly desirable. Nothingness is extremely liberating. And in Chinese tradition, you know, if you go back to Taoist tradition, everything that is comes out of nothingness. You know, so something comes out of nothing. It's not something's better than nothing. Something comes out of nothing. So, you know, when Western people think about nothing, we have a little frown on our faces and we think of the void, you know, something dead or something. But in East Asian tradition and in Buddhism also, in Indian tradition also, you know, shunyata, emptiness, is highly positive. It's like the source, and very energizing. So it takes people who are Western a little time to not run away from or recoil from this experience of emptiness that begins to happen on the cushion. And some people indeed do run away from it. It can be very uncomfortable, right? People may respond to it with distrust or even sort of sadness, like sadness. A lot of this is our cultural conditioning, though. If you stay with that emptiness for a while, that feeling of sadness or like threat, danger, will go away. And actually, you begin to experience that emptiness as like spaciousness. You know, and when I said to this person last night, you know, the reason your thoughts are not bothering you so much is that you're not trapped in your thoughts anymore. You know, there's like these empty spaces are opening up inside of your awareness. It's like you have a thought and then there's an empty space. You know, at first, because our minds are so crude, you know, our awareness is so crude, we don't notice lots of things. You probably read in the paper about I myself don't watch Game of Thrones. I'm not a game. I've watched one season and I'd had it, you know. But a lot of people watch Game of Thrones, and I was reading in the paper that they filmed this very crucial scene and somebody left a Starbucks coffee cup on the table. And it was in all they had stills of the shot, you know, it was just quickly, but somebody noticed it, and it went all over the world. Everybody knows about the Starbucks coffee cup. And you think, how did that happen, right? How did that happen? But, you know, everybody's in this world of their own thought stream, you could say. Everybody's in their world of their own thought stream. And you're in your thought stream, and I'm in my thought stream, and sometimes we are aware of each other. You know, we sort of like break out of our thought streams enough to be aware of each other. But a lot of the time, we're in our own thought stream, and lots of things pass us by, miss us, you know, or we miss them. And it's definitely the case that we get so embedded in our thought stream, we can't notice lots of things. Or we become very crude spirited, you could say. You know, so when we begin, ordinarily, you know, it's like thought, and you know, in Buddhist thinking, sense impressions are also like thoughts. So you know, you're thinking about the report you have to do for your boss. You realize that you're hungry and you haven't had any lunch and it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Then you realize something else. You know, then you hear a siren going off outside. You know, then you realize I've got to get home before this happens. You're looking for your keys. It's like thought, or thought, sensation, thought, perception, thought. So there's like you're completely carried forward by your mental activity, and there's no space between one thought and another. And it's very easy under those conditions to think that this is who you are, right? That you are your thoughts. It's like when you stop paying attention to the world around you and you pay attention to your mind, it's just thought, 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 thought. And it's easy to say that's all there is, and also it's easy to say that those are my thoughts, right? But the interesting thing is that, you know, actually you don't control your thoughts. And in fact, this is what was so upsetting to this person that I was talking to last night. You know, you could come in and sit down on the cushion and say, I'm going to have a nice, relaxing sit. And then all through the sit, you replay some problem at work. Maybe your boss, gave you a bad write-up for the quarter for your performance. And, you know, you sit down on the cushion thinking, finally, I'm going to have some relief from this. And you sit there and you think about this and you think about this and you think about this. You don't control your thoughts at all. They're coming into your head and they're going out of your head moment after moment, you could say, into your head and out of your head. They're coming into your consciousness and going out of your consciousness. You're not controlling those, you're not choosing those, and you can't choose them. It's like that famous game, don't think of an elephant. Whatever you do, don't think of an elephant. So all you think about is an elephant. You know, you can't control your mental processes and because your thoughts are coming from someplace that you're not aware of. They just come into your field of consciousness and they go away. Most people identify like 100% with their thoughts. Their thoughts are who they are. But when you begin to practice Zen and you begin to enter those, you begin to have those little spaces of emptiness, it has an effect on you. Because it's like you're suddenly putting some distance between yourself and your thoughts. And actually, even though that might seem trivial to you, if you've been practicing for a few years, that might happen fairly often. You know, but when you begin to open a space between yourself and your thoughts, that's really the beginning of being liberated. Because when you can separate yourself from your thoughts, when you enter that empty space periodically and you separate yourself from your thoughts, you can see your thoughts coming and going like clouds in the sky, but they're not you. You really aren't your thoughts. They're just coming into your field of vision and leaving. And normally we're carried along helplessly by our thoughts. And if you've ever been in a distressing situation and you've been unable to break free, it's very painful because usually our thoughts have some kind of an emotional character. So you know, if you've been traumatized, for example, very hard, right, to get out of those mental loops or something's very painful and difficult. But, you know, when you begin to do Zazen and you get into that state of mind where you're grounding your awareness or you're returning to that fundamental emptiness at the core of your mind, the thoughts begin to come and go and they're no longer gripping you, or really you're no longer holding on to them as though they were the truth of who you are. So a thought is coming and a thought is going, a thought is coming and a thought is going. And, you know, people don't appreciate this enough. If you turn on the radio and listen to the radio and you turn the dial, you know, it would be mental illness to think of yourself as the source of all that information, right? Or if you turn on the TV and it's it's one lousy thing on TV after another, it would be crazy to say, "Oh, I feel so guilty today. All that's on TV are these lousy shows." About flipping homes in Miami or something. Because you're not supposed to identify with them. But you actually have no more control over your own thoughts, actually, than you do over what you happen to see on TV when you turn on the TV. It's its own little system. The thoughts are coming and they're following their own little laws of cause and effect. So it's very important not to be the prisoner of your thoughts. And when you begin to get into emptiness, into mushin, you see the thoughts come and go, and sometimes you see emotions come and go. So you can see your boss saying, this is not well done. You can see your emotions arising, but you're not embracing them. They're coming and they're going. And with practice, you begin to repose in that emptiness. That becomes like your baseline. Your baseline consciousness becomes this empty place. And even though in the West we think of emptiness as a bad thing, it's actually the source of our freedom. In Indian and Chinese thinking, this was well understood. So actually nothing is always better than something. See? So when you ground yourself or you return to that emptiness, you can begin to occupy a place where you're unperturbed by your mental productions. And this is so important. This is really like the beginning of liberation. And, it will definitely be the case that if you can do this, things will bother you much less. It's not just thoughts, but things that are actually perceptions and things that are actually unfolding in front of you don't have to trigger these automatic responses, these conditioned responses. Right. Most of our emotional responses are not ours either. When my wife and I were living in Seattle, we had a little cat. And it wandered into our apartment off the street. His name was Moon, and he was wonderful. He was a little Norwegian forest cat. If you're a cat fancier like I am, and you Google Norwegian forest cat, you will have thousands of pictures of the cutest cats in the world. And he wandered in, and he became our beloved cat. But, a garbage truck used to come right next to our apartment, and my wife was afraid that Moon would get, somehow picked up by the garbage men. It was just an anxiety she had. So when the garbage truck came, she used to take our cat and hide him. Like she'd put him in a drawer. She taught him how to be afraid. And it was actually a big mistake, because later when he would hear noises like that, he would get very anxious, right? We conditioned him. Well, a lot of our emotional life is like that too. Right? We've been conditioned to feel certain ways. It's not our choice. We're not in charge. So being able to get to that empty place is so liberating. Because, you have these emotions that you didn't choose. You have this conditioning. You didn't condition yourself. And when you can get into that emptiness, you begin to have a distance. And you see your fear. You begin to feel anxious and you hear the garbage truck, but you realize, I don't have to be anxious when I hear the garbage truck. So this is the beginning of real freedom. Real freedom. And it's a little different from what we're taught, because, as we're growing up, we're supposed to share in the common responses, right? Learning to be a human being is learning to respond the same way as everybody else. So, nothing is more awkward than being at a table with somebody who laughs at the wrong time. It's like, what's wrong with you? We're all supposed to laugh at the right things, right? And if somebody's laughing at the wrong time, we begin to look at him as strange or odd. And so part of being a human being is learning how to have the same emotions as other people, and learning to laugh at the right things at the right time and not, shriek when you hear a joke, but laugh when you hear a joke. So we're conditioned. We learn to be conditioned by society and accept the conditioning. But it's not all good for us. a person of the great way, a person of the Tao, knows that that's a game people play, but doesn't take it too seriously, doesn't buy into it, right? So you know, this person who came last night and said, you know, for some reason, my thoughts are not bothering me so much tonight. And then I said, well, I think that's because you're having more moments of emptiness on the cushion. And he said, you know, I think you're right. And you know, he had forgotten, really, how liberating this emptiness really can be. And he said, you know, actually, and again, he said this out loud, so I don't think it's giving away a secret. He said, my wife has been telling me to come and sit on us on Friday night because I my mood is so much better for the rest of the weekend. And I definitely believe that. I think people feel consciously or unconsciously trapped in their thoughts, you know, trapped in their emotions. And there often seems to be no way out of this, right? You know, one of the reasons people drink or they use drugs is because it gets them out of these mental routines. But being able to open up a space is really wonderful and so liberating. And people don't do it for complex psychological reasons. And one of them is that, you know, basically to follow the great way is to be kind of an outsider. You know, I actually think this is a significant fact. You know, to follow the great way is to be an odd duck, you know, an odd duck, kind of an outsider. You know, part of the consolation we get for being human beings is the pleasure of being one with others, right? Being one with others in an artificial way. You know, so yes, we go to a movie, we're watching a scene, everybody's laughing, we start laughing with them. We might not really find it funny. You know, are we laughing because we're finding it funny? Or are we finding it funny because we've been conditioned to laugh at these moments? See, I actually think it's the second one. See, I think what we call funny is what we've been trained to laugh at. And so, you know, basically we go along as we're growing up, we learn to go along with others, right? We learn to go along and do to like what they like and dislike what they don't like. And that gives us a kind of membership, right? Kind of membership. You know, we become a member of society. We become like everybody else. But I'm sure you know that this isn't an easy road to walk. You know, like I can remember when I was a teenager just being so terrified of stepping out of line, of being unlike my peers. Now, I remember my mother bought me this shirt I just thought it looked wrong. I thought when I get on the bus, my friends are going to laugh at me. And I had this terrible anxiety that I wouldn't be approved of by my friends. The shirt wasn't cool. And I remember my mother and I having this. My poor mother, she was just trying to get everybody dressed, right? And now her son is arguing with her, I don't want to wear that shirt. And she just ironed it, you know? But I was fighting for my life, you know? I was going to get on the bus and then I would be outside the circle, you know? People would shut me out. So I think I actually put on like a dirty shirt, you know? My mother finally said, go, fine, wear a dirty shirt, you know? And it was probably a dirty shirt, but at least I felt like I was going to be accepted by my friends. You know, that's a kind of tyranny, right? You know, where you're in teenage years are the worst years. I was just reading about how, you know, intermediate school, like seventh grade, is like a hell. And the internet has made it even worse because, you know, people, apparently, lots of kids, you know, take selfies of themselves, and then they doctor the selfies. You can, apparently, you can adjust the selfie and do something. And they're very afraid that they're going to put out into the world a selfie that will invite ridicule. You know, this is like total slavery, right? This is a terrible situation, right? But we all do this. The technology has just exaggerated something everybody does. And so, you know, this is like a very unhealthy mentality. We have to be able to function in society. You know, so if you go to a movie and you laugh at the wrong time, people are going to look at you like you're nuts. So you learn, you have to laugh at the right time. But, you know, I think that the man of Zen or the woman of Zen understands that this is a kind of collective dream. This is a kind of collective fantasy, right? And you don't buy into it. You understand this is not real. This is not real. You know, so many things people believe in are fantasies. You know, so right now we're in a period where our beloved leader, you know, he says America first, America first. And lots of people, he has a big following, and, you know, they believe they're Americans first. But, you know, a funny thing is, I remember 2 years ago, at the 4th of July, somebody went down the street in WNYC and was asking people, what is the 4th of July all about? It was like not 1 in 10 people could say, this is the 4th of July, what's it about? They didn't know. It's the celebration of our country or something like that. One person said, it's Independence Day, which is actually correct. And then the reporter said, well, what did we get independence from? And somebody said, I think it was France. You know? Really, not 1 in 10 people answered any of those basic questions. So then you say, well, what does it mean to be an American? Right? I mean, what does it mean? It's just a symbol of our togetherness. But it becomes a prison when we can't see through it and see it as like a game we play that's not real. You know, so I think it's very important to develop a kind of, like, you could call it like spiritual maturity or a psychological maturity, where you realize that actually it sounds shocking to say, but the human world is not real. It's a human fantasy world, right? I mean, if you look at what's happening to the environment, while we are pursuing, while we are pursuing our consumer dreams, you know, we're cutting down more and more forests and so on and so on. And there's like this obvious split between the world we live in, which says you must have a new this, you must have a new that, you know, you buy this, buy that, and the biological reality, which we know is deteriorating very rapidly. But people can't change because they're, I think psychologically, it's so hard to break with the group or to go against the flow. You know, somebody like the Buddha was really interesting because in his culture too, we think, you know, in the Buddha's world, being a meditator, going off into the forest was a laudable thing. But actually, nobody in the Buddha's family wanted him to practice. You know, his father had a career all laid out for him. And what he did was really like socially disgraceful, actually. He disobeyed his father. He abandoned his wife and his child. You know, this is like, not just in Asia, but in the United States too. You know, you left, you abandoned your family. You know, you quit your job. You know, what a bad man you are. And he went out and you know, it's easy now to say, well, it all turned out well. He became the Buddha, but, you know, he was sitting in the woods meditating. He quit his job and abandoned his family. You know, that takes, I think, extraordinary courage. You know, and he went and studied with some of the foremost meditation teachers in his time. But even that, you know, he said, you know, I don't think you've got it. Again, you know, he could have easily stayed with these people everybody would say were the most advanced meditation teachers of the time, but he just walked out on them. You know, to practice the great way is to be kind of an odd duck. It is. It's to be willing to step outside the collective dream. Not all the time, right? You don't have to live in a monastery, and even a monastery can become a kind of collective dream too. But it you have to be willing to step outside the collective dream and be in that emptiness and see things in a new way. And when you go into that emptiness, it liberates you because it shows you this is a dream, right? This is a dream. Now, I don't have to be upset, you know? I don't have to be upset right now. I don't have to be afraid. I've been conditioned to be afraid. I've been conditioned to be upset. You know, I don't have to believe these stories that my society has told me. You know, I can remember when I finished my, you know, dissertation. It took me 8 years, something like 7 or 8 years, to finish my dissertation and get my PhD. And I spent thousands of hours. When I think of how many hours I spent writing my dissertation, you know, it was amazing how many hours I spent on that. And when I finally finished and got my dissertation and went to graduation and received my PhD, it felt like absolutely nothing. It was like, it wasn't like they handed me the diploma and shook my hand and was like, oh, you're a different, you know, it's like absolutely nothing. You know, I should have gone to the movies. That was kind of, I should have gone to the movies today, you know. It's socially symbolic, but it was personally utterly meaningless to me, you know. It's socially important, but you know, I've talked about this. I have a friend of mine who is one of the foremost people in his field, and you know, we occasionally have lunch. And one time he said, "Yeah, I've written a lot of books. I wonder if I haven't wasted my life." You know, so I'm not sure writing all those books was what he really wanted to do with his life. He did what he was told to do, right? So at any rate, you know, to be a man of Zen or a woman of Zen is to be willing to risk at least a few hours a week stepping outside the collective fantasy of the human world and encountering something which is bigger than the human world. Even the human is a fantasy, right? We say animal, human. This is pure fantasy. It's not real. You know, I was just reading an article about how many different species of animals perform many of the mental functions we perform, including self-reference. They are aware of themselves. They are aware of other animals. You know, they can distinguish. Sheep can distinguish one sheep from another. They recognize this sheep and they ignore this sheep. You know, so you almost, you know, human consciousness has many things in common with the consciousness of other sentient beings. In Buddhism, we actually say sentient beings are what matters, not humans, because our teachings recognize that there are many forms of sentient being, and humans are just one of them, you know. So even humanity is a fantasy, right? Sentient being comes closer to the truth. So being a person of Zen means you're willing to be a little bit of an outsider a couple times a week at least, right? Where you say, yes, I know that's important, but I'm going to close the door and I'm going to meditate, or I'm going to come to Rutgers and meditate. And if somebody asks you, what good does it do? Please be sure to tell them, it's totally useless. Please be sure to say that. And you can have a big smile on your face. Because if it were useful, it wouldn't be liberating. See, use is also, usefulness is just a human term. It's also a collective fantasy. See, there are people who won't come to sit here on a Saturday. They said, I'm going to come to sit, and they don't come to sit. And I'll say, oh, come on, try it. And they say, I'll be there this Saturday. They don't show up. And this goes on and on. And I'll say, can I call you? I'll call you. You know, I'll call you at 6. And they laugh. No, not necessary, but they don't come. If I said, I will give you $500 if you show up, they would show up. Now, I'm not insulting them. I'm just saying that's useful. See, making $500 for coming to sit is useful. But, you know, it would not change your life at all to get those $500. What would change your life is doing something that has no value, that has no meaning. Because it's free. It's bigger than meaning. It's bigger than value. So, you know, emptiness is not nothing. It's bigger than something. You know, when you sit down on the cushion and you're doing something that has no value, it's superior to value. It's superior to value. You know, a person who practices the great way is truly free. That person, she or he, is superior to value, is superior to achievements. That's a truth. You know, if you go to the library, I'm an English professor, and you can go and you can do research, and you can say, in 1955, these were the most famous literary critics in the world. And if you say to somebody, have you ever heard of George Smedley? They will say, who? This is even in English. They don't know. You know, that's like writing your name in the sand. These things come and go, you know. They come and go. The great way, I would say, is superior to recognition, is superior to achievement. And, you know, the more we cling to the human world as though it's real, I think the less happy we become. You know, like this person last night, the human world is a wonderful world when we're not imprisoned by it. So, you know, when I can be, I love people. I love the people I work with. I love my wife. I love my family and my sister, my brother, my late brother's kids. I love them. And I have my neighbors. I do things with my neighbors. I love their company. But I think what makes it so refreshing for me to be around people is to be able to get to this other place, where I'm not trapped anymore in my thoughts and my feelings. You know, it's living a bigger life. And in fact, you know, I think, you know, in Chinese Buddhism, they say if you practice Chan, if you practice Zen, it's a benefit for 7 generations to your family. And I believe that. I think if you can enter deep wuxin, and liberate yourself from your compulsive behaviors, your fears and your attachments, you're a much better father, mother, teacher, worker, boss, because you know this is a game and I'm going to play it in the most generous and humane way I can. And I'm not going to be driven by my fears and my attachments. Ryutan's constant principle. Even as you call it thusness, it's already changed. Everything we give a name to changes instantly. Where knowledge doesn't reach, avoid speaking of it. Here, is there any investigating or not? Ryuan asked Yanto, what is the fundamental constant principle? What is it that never changes? Yanto says, moving. Ryuan said, when moving, what then? Yanto said, you don't see the constant principle. Ryuan stood there thinking. Yanto said, if you agree, you are not free of sense and matter. You're still trapped in the fantasy. If you don't agree, you'll be forever sunk in the fantasy. So it's bigger than agreeing and disagreeing. Verse, the round pearl has no hollows. The great gem isn't polished. What is esteemed by people of the way is having no edges. Having no attachments. Removing the road of agreement, senses and matter are empty. The free body resting on nothing stands out unique and alive.